This is the Misdirected Mark Podcast, a podcast about gaming, game mastering, and entertaining you, our listeners. We are explicit, and you have been warned, and I'd like to thank Mike Willer for letting us use his music on our show. Now let's pick up those mics and get on with this thing.
Why, yes, so yes, so yes, it is time to pick up those mics and get on with this thing. Just like getting on with putting the man down where he belongs, punching some capitalism in the face, and hearing all about misspent youth with our very special co-host, the designer of the game, Robert Ball. Welcome to the show, Rob. How you doing?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
I'm great. My name is Chris.
And I'm Phil.
And I'm Old Man Logan.
And Rob, who are you and what makes you notable?
I'm Robert Ball, and Will Wheaton played my game.
Oh, there you go.
There it is.
That's about it. That and I've been, you know, I was a podcaster of the Independent Insurgency, and I've been in the indie RPG design scene since 2005, and I published Misspent Youth, which, as I said, is now on Will Wheaton's tabletop.
Yeah, actually, Misspent Youth is one of the first indie, and I use indie in quotes, of that generation, indie games I ever picked up. I picked it up at the same time that I picked up Dogs in the Vineyard, and Dread. I bought all three of those games at the exact same time.
That's amazing company to be in.
Right? this is what we usually do. I say, what is going on? So, Rob, what is going on with you?
What's going on with me is a newborn exploded my life, as someone said recently. we had a baby less than a week ago, and you may hear some sound effects. I called it on one of the Kickstarter or one of my social media posts, a surprise stretch goal. For the
Kickstarter. That's funny. Name, gender, size, all that good stuff?
Her name is currently on the internet. Her name is Monica To Come.
Nice.
Or MTK. She's a girl, and she's really chill. I'm hopeful that will continue, but then, you know, she's suffused with bilirubin and she's getting out of her body, which makes her tired, and she's a newborn, so she basically eats and poops and sleeps. So.
Well, welcome to not sleeping anymore for a while.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And I think there's some special badge for running a Kickstarter and having a newborn simultaneously. I think there is some award.
Yeah. I'm also sending my 18-year-old to college. There's like two or three other things that I'm doing.
Holy Lord.
Yeah, the service I was hired on with my new job went live July 1st, so I'm skipping out of a new job just as it gets started. So yeah, it's all coming together.
Oh man,
wow!
When it rains, it pours, right? Like just kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
Phil, man, how about you? What's going on with you?
I had a lot of planning stuff for work in the last week or two. So work wise, I'm like a little stressed because. It's launch day, so all the planning that I did up the last couple weeks now all has to actually go smoothly, which it never does. So I am now just day-to-day, you know, piloting this dumpster down the hill. I did some more writing for H2O. I'm getting really close to end of Sprint 4. I already know Sprint 5 is going to be Gear, which is like the one chapter I haven't written for the game yet. Mm-hmm. I did some more reading of DCC because despite the shelf of story games I have, I can't help myself. That game is there's just something about it.
It calls to you.
It's drawing me in. I'm kind of digging it. Plus, I colored all my crazy dice on Sunday. I got a set of game science Zachi dice, and then like with the crayon went old school and colored them all in.
Did it not come with a D7, or did they just forget it?
No. So here's the thing: the game science one. So I got the precision ones.
Yeah.
The clear. Yeah. I got the red clear ones. They don't make a clear D7 yet,
which is weird.
They have like an opaque one, but it doesn't come in that set. So yeah, I got finished with all the dice, and I'm like, oh, this is good. And then I look back at the DCC dice chain, and I'm like, wait, I don't have a D7. I solved that problem today on eBay. I acquired a pair of D7s.
That's a dick move. I didn't know that about DCC. Is that like a joke or something? Or is that like really integral?
No, so you can get away with it because the they tell you how to do it with regular dice, but the way it works is there's like a chain of dice, and so it's the six standard ones you remember. And then there's a D3, a D5, a D7, 14, 16, 24, and 30. And instead of flooding you with a bunch of pluses and minuses, they just start moving up and down the dice chain. So they'll just be so they'll be like your second attack, instead of being at -4, you just roll a d16 instead of a d20.
That was Misspent Youth's original system.
Yeah.
Every trait that you could find that was relevant to the roll, you got to bump a die size, and every trait that was involved that was bad for your roll, you had to bump down a die size.
Yeah.
Well, why'd you kill it then?
Because it was terrible.
Oh, okay, there you go.
Yeah, so but, you know, it was three dice or two dice that those three dice, like once all three graduated, the next one could graduate, which was a fun little thing to do. But it was really kind of like Misfit used a fast game, and that's fiddly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's super fiddly, and there's a lot about DCC that's super fiddly. But I'm kind of digging it, and again, it's like kind of a really departure for me from like the last couple years of gaming. But I'm still kind of excited about it.
Yeah, I mean,
that's real confidence. They're like, we have new kinds of dice for you.
Yeah, it's playing a game with even weirder dice than the dice I've had for like the last 30 years.
Yeah.
So that game, awesome. I feel like they built that game for people who who really wanted some weird ass old school Renaissance type play.
Well,
and then they made it for people like me who like satire, because it's built on purpose to be bizarre.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't want to chip a whole bunch of time, but I don't think satire is what they're going after. I think it's deliberately complicated in places, and then it's streamlined in other places.
Yeah, it's deliberately. Stroh and company, they made it deliberately complicated on purpose because they're trying to mock or make fun of or showcase that kind of play.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to spin this off into another show.
Yeah, that'll be another episode.
Because I think Hackmaster is very much satire.
Well, sure.
But yeah, I think DCC is a little less satire.
Yeah, there's a difference between good satire and bad satire, though, man.
Anyway, I've been digging that. We played some SIG on Sunday when you were not feeling well, Chris, mm-hmm. and that went really well. Our emerging mystery is sprouting heads left and right in
very
terms
cool.
of potential, you know, leads. So we're gonna have to start culling some of those leads and actually drive that thing towards some sort of conclusion. But I'm digging it. I'm getting the hang of SIG. Like I'm getting the hang of how the game plays. All right. Robert. Oh yeah. No, I can't do that. Sorry. Old Man Logan. So we don't mess up everybody.
We'll
Old Man Logan, because that's his real name is Bob.
One week as a Night Stalker down. Lovely night shift. 3 weeks to go. And I'm in the groove now, so I'm not totally zoned out like, oh my God, I'm tired because I'm working all night.
I noticed a smaller coffee.
The smaller coffee when I came in, yes. Finished up some D&D proofing. Wrapped up the proof of the Pip System core book for Third Eye Games. Getting ready to do Mermaid Adventures for him. And I'm looking away from the mic when I'm talking, which is probably bad. And because I'm working night shift and it's nice and slow so far, and I'll get pounded tonight because of that, but I get to play some Minecraft, so doing some of that. And of course, SIG on Sunday night. This was only my second session with SIG, so I'm still kind of wrapping my head around how the system works and everything like that, because I missed a few in between, but it's an interesting game, and we have an interesting mystery on our hands, so looking forward to beating on some of that. Chris, how about you, man?
All right, real quick. I've been working on the Cubicle 7 website. That's been fun to do web design over there. I've been reading Over the Edge for the playtest, because I'm going to be running that on Fridays with some folks like Rob Abrazzato and Michael Dinos and Nikki. The QCC early registration is coming up soon. I edited Bone Stone and Obsidian Episode 2, which should be out when most of you are hearing this. And I edited the rest of the Paranoia AP that we played a while ago, so that'll be out in the next couple of weeks, too. And that's pretty much what I've done, because we got more important things to talk about, like Misspent Youth. So that is our announcement for this week, which is Misspent Youth, Sell Out With Me. So that is the game that is kickstarting currently, while Robert Ball is having a new job and a baby, and his life is going crazy. So it's well-funded. It's at $23,000 of the $10,000 it was looking for. It's got 633 backers. There's still 8 days to go. Rob, what is different? And you know what? I can actually just tell people what's different. So the game is actually essentially the same. The game is about what are you willing to put up, what are you willing to sacrifice to fight the man? I mean, you're going to lose pieces of yourself, of your independent revolution that is you. Basically, things on your character sheet that you will cross off with ink in order to succeed at things when you need to succeed at those things. And at some point in time, you'll either hopefully quash the man or stand up for what you believe in enough to make a difference in the world, but you'll eventually, you know, conform to society in some way, shape, or form. Did I pretty much get that right?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. Basically, the game is about trying to change the world and stop stop authoritarianism or whatever. And the key is every now and then you're going to lose, and you can choose instead of losing to do something really terrible that makes you more like the authority and permanently burn something useful and good about yourself, which is called selling out. And then once someone has completely sold themselves out, that's the last episode of the series, and you see if you've changed the world enough in that time to prevent the catastrophe that will ruin everything you care about from happening, or if you failed, if the authority won and its vision of a horrific future is sticking.
Very cool. So if you want to get in on this game, it's $15 for the PDF. That's a pretty low price point, and this is a update of the game that was published many, many years ago at this point. And
yeah, I should add that's $15 for two PDFs, for the core book and a supplement.
Mm-hmm, the supplement that has five worlds in it, right?
The supplement, no. So the core book added five worlds written by me.
Okay.
And that's also got, you know, a bunch of little editing fixes that don't change the rules at all. The supplement is 17 worlds and two hacks, or sorry, 18 worlds and two hacks. By various authors, none of whom are me, showing all the different ways that the system can be used.
Yeah, there's a lot of good ones in there too, of folks that we appreciate. Like Strix is one of the writers. Matt McFarlane from the IDGN is one of those writers. Quinn Murphy, we love Quinn Murphy around these parts. So
Quinn's great.
Yeah, cool stuff. And a number of other Hannah Schaefer, who was on the show not too long ago, Alex Roberts. Like these are that's a really good list of people to have writing on this game.
Caitlin Bell. I mean, I literally have a list, and now that we've named so many, I want to name them all, but I won't do that.
Here, I'll just do it for it. Ajit George, Misha, I always...
Furjaeger.
Yeah, thank you. Judd Carlman, Kimberly Larn, Daniel Levine, Kira McGran, Michael Miller, Joshua A.C. Newman, Dev, I can't say that last name.
Parkayasta.
Thank you. Thank you. Jared Sorensen, who I'm very, very fond of as a designer, Daniel Swenson, Kurt Thompson, Rachel E.S. Walton, Bill White, and Gregor Vuga.
Yep.
There you go.
Did you get Caitlin Bell in there?
You said her. Well, you said her name, so I just didn't bother.
Yeah, I said it first. Yeah. So that's everybody. And if you know, like, indie gaming, that's like a superstar group plus newbies that are great plus mainstream publishing representation, I'm really, really happy with it.
Yeah, it's a hell of a list.
Yeah.
It really is, and you got a bunch of good artists on there too. So, I mean, I would just go. You should go to the Kickstarter, take a look at it, see if you're interested in this game, which I think you should be. I mean, it's a very cool game, it really is.
I'll also note that if you go to the website, you can download the older, identical rules wise version for free. It's the paper layout, which is a little hard on the eyes in PDF. But you can see what the game is and what the game that, you know, Will and Amy and Matt and Kelly Sue all played on tabletop right now.
Oh, nice.
Cool.
Now, I would tell people to get in on the $50 level, but it's sold out.
People have asked me to like open up signatures, but it's already 100 signatures. I don't know how many is too many, but I figure 100 is good.
Yeah, that's a good number. All right. I mean, there are other things I suppose we could talk about the Kickstarter, but really we're going to use the game as the example when we talk about social justice and social injustice in games. So if you don't mind, we'll just move on. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, here's an ad for Wayward Masquerade and Micro Thulu. So here we go. We've seen Bag Thulu. We've seen Mini Thulu.
We've even seen Backpack Thulu.
But what you didn't see coming, because it was so small, was Micro Thulu.
What? Wait, there's a Thulu smaller than Mini Thulu?
Why, yes, there is. And it also comes in 20 itty-bitty colors, is right around 2 inches tall, and is adorable in its insanity.
Does it still have wings and tentacles?
It sure does, but you better get your Micro Thulu pre-order on BackerKit quick.
Why is that?
Because there's only going to be 50 of these custom, handcrafted, adorably insane plushies made by Bridget from Wayward Masquerade. And Bridget from Wayward Masquerade isn't sure she'll ever make any more of them.
Oh man, I better go make a pact with Azathoth now to get one.
You do that, and while you are, I just want the folks at home to know MicroThulu does come with an attachment point, so you can hang your adorable insanity off your key ring, on your rearview mirror, and on your ceremonial sacrificial dagger, you use in those dark rites to contact Yogg's the Sothoth.
I hear Yogg really likes it when you include MicroThulu in those rites.
Me too. It's almost like he appreciates the touch of plush while he rips apart the gates of reality when we call.
Do, 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 do.
There we go.
All right. Here's the bumper. Welcome to the workshop, where we try to build better games.
That's the less metal
workshop bumper. It totally is, because I'm using the iPad with the other bumper to talk to Robert.
Oh, so you didn't upgrade this one?
I haven't upgraded. Well, I didn't have a chance to because we got down here a little late.
I got it.
And things were a little bit confusing.
No, it's fine. Day. I just wanted to know why you went with the weaker, less metal bumper.
I agree. I mean, that is okay. Way less metal. I mean, luckily, Robert couldn't hear it, so it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, it's less embarrassing for our guest to hear that bumper.
All right, so let's do that thing we do when we have a guest co-host in the show and look at a gaming topic where the guest can provide a unique perspective based on their body of work. Tonight, we are asking Robert Ball to talk about designing games that include social justice as a central component. We're going to keep our talk focused on social justice and injustice as a concept. We'll be using examples both real-world and not, and the game, Misspent Youth. But the goal of this discussion is not to weigh in on them as much as use them as examples. And to do that, we are going to ask Phil to define and frame out our discussion tonight. So what is the definition of social injustice and justice, Phil?
Yeah, so let's just start right from Wikipedia. Social justice is the fair and just relation between the individual and society. This is measured by the explicit and tactic terms for the distribution of wealth, opportunities for personal activity, and social privileges. Therefore, we can define social injustice as the unfair relation between the individual and society. So let's talk about some real world examples and some fantasy examples, because I want to keep the topic more on the design part. But let's talk about things like poverty, including access to food. My personal favorite, because this is right out of Hydro Hackers, drinkable water.
Mm.
Or we can talk about the distribution of money, etc. We talk about things like the death penalty, rights for certain groups, labor laws, access to education. And then we can do some non-real world examples. The clearing of non-humans from a grove for a kingdom.
It's like the plot of Shrek.
Yeah. The rate for clean air tanks on an off the rate of the cost for clean air tanks on an off-world mining colony. Or should superhumans be registered with the government?
Yay, civil war.
Yeah, there you go. So social injustice has some components. So first of all, there's the injustice itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the rule, the law, the tradition, or superstition that creates the unfair relation between the affected group and society. Then we have our affected group. This is the group of people on which the injustice occurs. Society, this is our group of people at large. The affected group is a subset of society. The authority. This is the force that's able to enforce the injustice and prevent and resist it from changing. And this can be a person. This can be a group of people. So it can be like a government agency, a king, a corporation, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. And then we have allies. These are people who are not in the affected group, but are sympathetic to the injustice and can offer aid or assistance.
Yeah. Now, social injustice can be part of a setting or a backdrop, or it can be the opposition that the campaign will focus on. So as a backdrop, the injustice is part of the setting, but the campaign nor the mechanics of the game are about changing that injustice. Here's a few examples. The Kingdom of Caloria uses drow slaves for mining the Great Mountain. In fact, I think the game that just is kickstarting right now, The Spire, is all about this by Grant Howitz. It is about dark elves rebelling against their high elf oppressors.
Yes, but in that case, The Spire is not a backdrop game.
No, it's not a backdrop game.
Right.
But if the mechanics weren't specific to it, it would be,
yes.
Sort of. Yeah. In this case, the characters know that it is happening, but they are indifferent, or the campaign moves away from this location next week and is forgotten. As an opposition, the injustice often affects the characters directly. They are the affected group or are allies of the affected group. There's an authority that is established and enforces the injustice and the societal norms. I think that is one of the things that you do in campaign setup in Misspent Youth. Is that correct, Robert?
Yeah, you. Each player names something that fucks with the lives of the youthful offenders. The clique is the name of the group. And it's important that it's something that screws them and doesn't just make the world bad.
Mm. Then there's the campaign, which is structured for the characters to clash with the authority. The goal of the campaign is for the characters to attempt to remove the injustice through action. So misspent youth, we already mentioned how the authority is kind of set up by the players, but social justice it's an opposition. And then the focus of the game is to overcome that in social injustice. That is we've mentioned it already. That's totally the premise of the game, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Misspent youth and like everything I write, I guess, is about social injustice. Cause I'm also writing Demi-Humans, which is basically that game. It's a Powered by the Apocalypse game, really an Apocalypse World hack about demi-humans at the start of the human age being pushed out.
Oh, that's interesting. I'd play that. I can't wait to see that.
I'm glad. I'll put it for you someday.
Oh, thanks.
But yeah, Misspent Youth takes all those things. Like it asks you to talk about the structure of power. It makes you talk about the nature of that authority and how that affects, you know, basically you create the authority first before you create characters or even the world. You create the authority the very first thing so that it's all integrated. And the systems of control that we talked about before, everyone coming up with something that screws their lives personally, that's kind of the structure, that's the thing that tells you whether you've changed the world enough. Because the authority has systems of control and the youthful offenders have exploits. And in every session, if you win the session, if you win that story, you have the opportunity to create a system of control, or even better, to subvert. You have the opportunity to create an exploit, or even better, subvert a system of control into your control and becoming one of your exploits. And every episode that you succeed at that, you start out with only one exploit, and you start out with as many systems of control as there are youthful offenders.
Oh,
so, you know, you've got like 4 to 5 sessions to win against the authority before one of you sells out entirely. So yeah, it's taking all of those, like as you were saying, I was like, there's the part of my game, there's that part of my game. So it's, yeah, it all lines up for that.
Yeah, well, let's rock it out real quick. So like the injustice is a thing that you are setting up then. So that is you create your authority, which is another one of the things that you create, and then they're creating some sort of injustice. And then the affected group is probably the youthful offenders, right?
Can we ask Rob to like actually give an example like from one of the worlds in the
book? Yeah, sure, it's a great idea. So what is an authority and what is an injustice that they provide in one of your worlds?
So the one I'm thinking about right now is really, really fucking cool. It's Bill White's Rage and Resentment, Jane Austen's Misspent Youth. And what it is, the authority is the English patriarchy of the Regency era. And the youthful offenders are a group of friends who are all gathered to attend the wedding of one of those characters. And the authority has a need, which is the thing it's always trying to achieve moment to moment, and the thing that'll happen if it succeeds against you. And its need is to keep women safe, and if they don't stop the authority, then they're all going to wind up in unhappy marriages. And so that's that. There's no fabulousness. There's no magic there. But like the systems of control are things like the fact that women have to be chaperoned, or
they have to marry who their parents tell them to marry.
Yeah, yeah. They're under a lot of, you know, control from everybody in their life. So like, yeah. So here I've got the systems of control up here. So reputation, it's very important for a young lady to have a positive reputation. So the authority can always threaten their reputations. Gossip, people are talking about people all the time. Dependence, women can't do anything on their own, their property. Chaperonage, you can't go anywhere alone. And class-based etiquette, because you're upper class, there's all sorts of things you can't do that country gentlemen and women can do. But then the exploit is gallantry. So your secret power is that your fuck society has said that men have to dote on rich women who have prestige and a good marriage. So that's your way in. And then as you play this game, you could find ways to maybe cancel chaperonage or subvert chaperonage so that it's things that women do for one another as a cover to allow them to do things freely. Somehow they get it that women can chaperone one another, that kind of thing.
Hmm. So we mentioned a few things like injustice, affected group, society, authority, allies. So the injustice is all the injustices are those systems of control. The authority is we've already established they're the white aristocracy.
Yeah, it's sort of a two-part thing, because the first thing you do, the very, very, very first thing you do is name the things that authority that bullies do in the real world that piss you personally off. And that gives the authority player a list of things to do to you.
Oh, there you go.
Because the way the system works, you need to push people to be willing to say, I'm going to grab those dice. So they hand you these things that personally annoy them, and then they offer things that take away their freedom and the things that matter to their character. So between those two things, they're handing you these tools to whip and goad them with. It's the funny thing is it turns out to be really mean for certain people running the game, because I know this guy Kevin Weiser from the Walking Eye podcast once ran the game for a bunch of women and non-white people, and he was the only white guy, and he was like, all right, so name your things, and they named everything, you know, basically terrible that white people do. White guys do to you know, other people. And then his job was to embody all that for these people, all these things he disagreed with. It's a wonderful, evil little trap that I love.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about safety in a few questions.
Oh, man.
We're definitely going to talk about safety.
All right, well, that was an excellent example. And with that definition set up and that example, let's talk about how to design social injustice as an opposition into your game. Phil, take it away.
Yeah. So Rob, what was your first experience in gaming where either your character or as a GM, you had like social injustice as part of the game?
Oh, wow. The one that rises immediately to mind was a one-on-one or maybe two-on-one game of GURPS with my friend Judd Carlman and my brother Jason, mostly probably Judd. And the setup was Toy Story before there was Toy Story. So we were the toys of these kids that whose power were, you know, determined by how much love the child had for them. And this was the late 80s. And the villain were video games that were taking all the creativity away from kids, making them sit in front of TVs and sort of just sucking up all their time and making all of these, like my brother's character was like this snot blob that you'd get from like, or maybe that was me, from like a 25 cent, you know, bubble toy thing.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah. So that was it. It was the evil video games and the sisters invading Barbie army against the boys, crappy toys.
That's awesome. And in GURPS, no less. I love
GURPS.
It.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which exactly what source books do you use for playing the toys in GURPS?
I think it was GURPS Core. I think it was, you know, nice. Judd was already a good, you know, it's so long ago. I'm not sure if I was GMing or Judd was GMing or who was playing, but I know Judd and I were involved, and one of us was brilliant enough to like game design those sorts of things on the fly. Well, I have to say, actually, speaking of GURPS, that it's kind of a game design primer, because that's the first place that I kind of that thing where you've got damage, but the damage is separable from the color. That's right there, game design. That's telling the players, you know, that's like designing an Apocalypse World move. You know, you know what you want the mechanics to do. The mechanics are the same. Let's say for Rita Sitch, in most many Apocalypse World have like a Rita Sitch power, and then each game iterates that by saying, "Here's the color that goes with that."
Yeah, that's like Discern Realities in Dungeon World,
right?
Or Masks. It's Masks has actually got two of them. It's Pierce the Mask, and it's because that's the one about reading people. Then the other one is I forget what it's called, but it's the one that lets you ask questions about the situation. So yeah. Because they color it for the – I mean, that's the whole thing about Apocalypse World, right? Like the Apocalypse World hacks, I should say, powered by the Apocalypse games is they're just coloring their moves to do specific things to reinforce the genre.
Yeah, a lot of them do add in, you know, significant game design as well. But I feel like most of them start that way. They start with here's an easy leg up toward design, and I'm going to use this, and then I'm going to build out. And what I think is great about that, that's how I design. Like, Misspent Youth is a combination of like Dogs in the Vineyard, Shock, Primetime Adventures, My Life with Master, Fate, you know, and probably a half dozen other games that wind up being a quote unquote unique new system, you know?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about designing games, really, you're just the thing about that we don't talk about, I guess, a lot with role-playing game design is that games are a collection of mechanisms and how they interact create a play experience. And we do that. We talk about board games like that all the time, but a lot of people don't talk about role-playing games that way, and maybe they should. I mean, we aspire at least here to talk about games more like that. Like, that's why we have garages where we break down actual mechanisms of play and say how they're used in different ways that they can be used. So maybe we should start talking more about role-playing games as they're the distinct mechanisms within the game and how they affect play.
Yeah, well, that's the Forge. And that's what we did at the Forge, and that's why I'm a game designer, because their attitude wasn't like, I feel like before, my experience was before the Forge, most game design was, we all know that you need to create a physics engine, and that you need to mortgage your house, and that you need to get a big company to buy your game. But to me, the Forge was about kind of deconstructing all that and saying, you know, you have to take the game rules, not based on what's always been done before, but based on containing and controlling and guiding human interactions between adults at a table, and start looking at it that way.
Yeah. And the Forge, I mean, I was post Forge. I went back and I was lucky enough because Ed Healy gave me the source code for the old Forge stuff. So I could actually go back and read all those boards
after
they were all done. But I mean, that we don't have that anymore, really. I mean,
no,
it doesn't really exist, which is unfortunate, but like, hopefully some of us are still sort of aspiring to that, but we're having a lot of times to rediscover it on our own because we didn't have that collective of people, even though those folks could be really harsh to each other a lot of the time.
Yeah, it was like the Forge had a lot of great things about it, but there was definitely this machismo about how to argue, how to like throw down your big argumentation dick and make everyone cower because you're a smart guy. And, you know, clearly I didn't have much tolerance for that, but it had a lot of value to it as well. It doesn't happen anymore, but you know, I think where it happens now is in games designing in response to one another. Instead of a forum, we have people making games and saying, yeah, well, here's what I think.
I'm with you because, I mean, that's kind of what we do. We play and read a bunch of different games and then we just talk about them. And then we go and we design stuff ourselves and then we, you know, bring that to the community and then we talk about that. So we're a little less mean about it, though.
I spent my early 2000s with my nose pressed against the, you know, window of the Forge. Like I lurked on the Forge forever, but I was like, oh, I'm not putting a post up.
Let's get back on topic. Sorry, that was really fascinating, though. I will talk about that stuff for hours. What are some of the common tropes and tones of a game centered around social injustice?
I would say that that's tough. What are the so the common tropes? I would say, you know, are all the tropes of authoritarianism. You know, like faceless villains and people's personal lives being ransacked, and that trope, I guess, is not the right word for it, but that vibe of like just simmering rage while you have to quietly look down, you know.
Well, that's the tone, right? That's the backdrop feel of how it all plays out.
Yeah, so I think it's important in games about social justice that you feel that society is more powerful than you, and you feel like, at least initially or in many ways, that things are out of your hand. It doesn't matter how hard you punch. You're not going to turn capitalism warm and fuzzy. but that said, my game is a game that I frequently say it's the game where you can punch capitalism in the nose. But it does so only through grinding effort, right? You don't beat the authority in one session. It takes an indeterminate number of sessions that is based completely on luck and your willingness to burn yourself out and play a little bit strategically. So I think feeling like that feeling of hopelessness and a lack of quick power, and that the only thing you can do to make change is to grind it out. I think those things are important to a game about social justice, because like the problem is if it's like a D&D type game, then it's just a matter of like what my power is and who I can kill to get there, which, you know, I should step back and say most good DMs will be like, well, no, you can't kill an entire nation. But the game's workings don't look at what it does, what it takes to change the world. And I think I guess that's the third part of it. You know, you've got tropes, you've got tone, and you've got mechanics. And I think for a game to truly be about social justice, it has to be about changing the world and about how hard that is.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And we're going to ask about the how you mechanize that later.
I feel like we rolled right into question three. Why don't you just jump right into...
Yeah, sure, man. How do you design a setting around social injustice and a power that is holding that in place? What are some of the elements that we need to have for the authority in society? And we already kind of mentioned some of that stuff. Like, you talked about those systems of control and how you build those. Are they just... How do they function, though? Like, are they just, like, aspects in Fate? Or what are they... Like, do they just sit there and then you have to narratively overcome them to make some... Then engage them, the mechanisms of play, like you said, through luck, and then hopefully beat out the authority?
They're kind of like game aspects, like series aspects.
Yeah.
They're also kind of like issues in shock.
Okay.
So it's... What it is it's a feature of the world that's always there, a sci-fi thing about the world. Here's the core of it. It has to be a sci-fi thing about the world that makes it different from ours, that fucks with your lives personally. So it's a constant thing in the world. And when the authority player has to say, all right, shit, what do I do now? They look at the things you said that people hate, and they look at the systems of control. And those are the tools they use to attack people with, or to make people feel bad, or to frame their scenes or whatever. And fuck, there was another part of that I wanted to say, but I'm tired. Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, man. What do you got?
No.
Let's hit it then. Let's go with, how do you mechanize that struggle in the game? How do we know if what we're doing in the game is making a change? And I assume, you already mentioned it before, but if you could go into a little bit deeper, like, In any game, like, those systems of control, those labels, like, subverting them, changing them, or creating those exploits, which lets you probably go around them, because hence why they're called exploits, right? Those are probably the things that help you subvert the system.
Yeah, and but also I failed to mention that sort of one of the advanced modes of play in Misfit Youth is for the Yos to look at those systems of control as things to structure an episode around defeating. Because, you know, if you win in scene six, then you get to make up a new thing about the world. But if you want to, it's like mathematically advantageous to take away a system of control, take it out of that column and put it in your column of exploits. And because then it's sort of like, not only are you adding one to your column, you're subtracting one from theirs. And when the series ends, you need more exploits than they have systems of control or catastrophe that you offer at the start comes to pass. So if you're smart, savvy, Misspent Youth players, you say, okay, I hate patronage or chaperonage. So that's what I'm going to work toward. We're going to make sure we have scenes pointing at undermining chaperonage. And by scene six, I'm going to make sure that we frame the stakes of that fight around getting control of chaperonage as something that we own.
Yeah. So in other words, we're gonna push towards getting the Duke of Canterbury to be cool with letting his daughter not be chaperoned by proving that it's not such a big deal.
Right. Well, except that would be destroying the system of control. Then the authority gets to write a new one. The equivalent would be like getting the Archbishop to recognize that women are the best people to take care of women's, and in fact, young women know other young women. So you pick young women that you trust, and thereby it winds up becoming a secret that you have, a power, an exploit that you have that the authority can't comprehend.
Because they still think that control is in place, but it's not really in place.
Right.
So, okay, cool. I get that. Hey, does Shara have any questions for Robert?
No.
They're listening intently.
All right, cool.
Although Old Man Logan had to drop the band hammer.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Unwanted guests.
So would you like to continue on, Phil?
Yeah, absolutely. So in this next section, I wanted to talk about setting up and running games with social injustice as an obstacle. And so we talked about this just at the top of the segment, but let's take a few minutes to talk about safety. In terms of, people's safety at the table. So when we're setting up a game that has social injustice, do you have any safety tips? Like, are there any specific things in the game, or, you know, are you using some of the more standard safety measures?
Such as the X card.
Like an X card?
Yeah.
Or lines and veils.
I am so happy about the X card because it's useful to have that tool for games that don't take this into account. I prefer a world where every game takes safety into account and writes it into the rules to the extent that it's, you know, needed for that. Misspent Youth does it by it's sort of an earlier solution, and there may be better ways to do this, but Misspent Youth does it by basically indicating to everyone you're all want the same thing. The authority player wants the authority to lose. It hates the authority. The authority player is as disgusted by the authority as the Yos are. Decisions everywhere along the way, where a lot of games would say, the authority decides this. The authority certainly decides many things, but there's text throughout it in the game that says, that said, you know, you don't get to just do something unilaterally. This is a consensus-based game. So Misspent Youth achieves it basically by constantly rubbing your nose in consensus and making it about everybody being a fan of the characters before Apocalypse World said that. Everyone is a fan of the characters, and that's an imperfect. That's not as mechanistic as I would like, but I feel like it works because the vibe of the game. You know, it's like I have another game called A Facility, which is about waking up in a some kind of medical facility and you're being experimented on. And that game doesn't have a safety mechanic because it's a game about finding the things that make you upset and uncomfortable and pushing on those. And as part, the safety mechanic is telling everyone who plays the game, hey, you're going to go and get tortured by quote-unquote doctors who are going to try to convince you you're crazy. And as players, we're all going to try to find the things that kind of upset you and make you feel uncomfortable. So don't go here if you don't want to, please. We don't want you to be traumatized, you know?
Yeah.
That's not a done game either. If that was going to be a done game, I'd want to be a lot more careful than just that, but...
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So I think, sorry, I keep interrupting.
No, it's okay.
Motor mapping. But I think it's extremely important for games that are about injustice that the injustice not be carried to the play at the table. So games about injustice and games where you're going to be embodying characters who are being brutalized by their society, I think it's more incumbent on those games to take player safety into account and to take the kinds of abuse that can happen into account. I wrote this thing, a reverse Batman world for Misspent Youth, where Batman's the villain because he's a billionaire and beats up property criminals. There's a Joker-like character and a Harley Quinn-type character, and I just presented them closer to the way they are in the books without it being an abusive relationship, being a healthy relationship, but being basically, you know, the Joker's in charge and all that kind of stuff. And I had a friend who was like, look, this is an abusive relationship that a lot of people romanticize. And so you need to kind of neutralize that so that people don't just go ahead and play that abuse as a fun, happy thing. And so this friend wanted me to make a Harley character the abuser. What I instead decided was to be a little bit more subtle with it and say, Harley's actually the one in charge. She's the one with the energy, and she's the one who says, all right, we're doing this now. And everyone's like, fuck, all right, we got to do this because we're already doing it. And thereby sort of indicate that she doesn't take everyone's consent into mind. There's text in there about how she knows what's best for her boyfriend, but it doesn't go fully into the abuse world, but it also reminds you of that abusive relationship and encourages you to run counter to it. So you have to be careful that in replicating abuse, you're not promulgating.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I could see where playing the authority figure, like, I could potentially be uncomfortable when I have to like turn the screws onto the players at the table.
Oh man, I was running a game of Fate. We were playing Dresden Files Accelerated, and one of the characters was African American, and they went into a very, very white neighborhood, and I had a sequence where some white cops showed up, and that was a really uncomfortable thing to play.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, and one of the cops was young and problematic, and the other cop was more comfortable with the situation, but the people there were also terrible. So that was it was weird to play that out.
Was it bad at the table, or if it wasn't, how did you avoid it being bad at the table?
It wasn't bad at the table because the people that we were playing with were, these are my friends, right? Like some of my closest friends.
Right.
And I didn't push it I pushed it pretty bad, but I didn't push it to the point where it could have been what we've seen in the news and things like that. So, I mean, those overtones were there, and the one cop had drawn on the African-American girl and said all the things that we've heard about. But it just – I just took my foot off the gas when it got to a point where it was making me and everyone else at the table a little bit more than it should have been. So it's just, you know, just feeling the table. I mean, we had an X card on the table too, so there's that.
Yeah.
But nobody touched it.
We played a game of Primetime Adventures once where it was a bunch of white guys playing black guys in the blues era with actual magic who were like jazz, like musicians as well. And we decided that we wanted racism to be a thing, but we didn't want to be a bunch of white guys throwing around those words. So we actually kind of had a little bit of fun with it where the camera of the game would cut just before anything that we didn't want to say happened, or someone would interrupt, or so it actually kind of became, we're drawing our attention to racism without replicating the worst aspects of it, and instead going sort of the more subtle, not the words but the effects, you know.
Mm-hmm. I also didn't use any of that terminology when I ran that sequence too, because I didn't want to do that. That's just,
yeah,
it's just not necessary, at least for what I was going for in that sequence.
No, I think you can use tone. You can use tone and inflection to get
also describing body language and how the younger 25-year-old white cop was acting.
Yeah,
like, and that's not to say that all white 25-year-old police folks are like
but
that is a thing that we've had a lot thrown in our face lately.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about something else. So. I mean, we could talk about that some more if you really want to. I think.
I agree with you. That was like a great, like, that was really ugly. Let's get that out of our systems and move on. I love that.
When running a game with social injustice enforced by a superior authority, what are some best practices for making that game enjoyable?
Making the players know that the bad guy player is not against them personally. There is this sort of this thing in the gamer culture of like delighting at evil GMs, you know.
Yeah.
And I get it; it's funny, it's nice to talk about. But in a situation where you're replicating that kind of societal injustice and bigotry, it's really important that everyone knows that everyone is on one another's side.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that for Misspent Youth, like. There's a lot of and it's sort of agenda like without being specifically agenda like in Apocalypse World and what, where you're like the authority player hates the authority and wants the authority to fail also, right? Like that is like a mandate, and that is like a procedure of play. It is not a mechanism necessarily, but it is a
rule. The way it's written in the text, it doesn't say this is a rule, but it's presented the way every other rule is, and you know, in several ways, you know, so that it's clear that it's not just this is some nice advice. It's sort of like procedurally structured. So, you know, like, for example, there's talk about how to bring up problematic content. I hate those two words together. I hate problematic content, but problematic content are too blah. Anyway, that the game says if you're going to bring up something that you think might be tough, say, hey, I'm going to bring up something and I want to make sure it's okay. There's a step in the game where with friendship questions where you make up things about the other characters in their backgrounds, and it says, look, you got a lot of power here, have fun with it, you know, say why did you stop being in love with me or something like that. But if you're going to impute something terrible about that character, like how did you stop being racist or something like that, you should get with that player and say, hey, you know, this is what I'd like to do to you, is that okay?
Yeah, we're always looking for consent from the other players when we're trying to impose something narrative on them.
Right, and it says so. It says you have to do that instead of saying you really ought to.
Yeah, so that's you wrote a procedure in there for narrative consent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a good rule. Do you want to go with the next one then?
Because that it dovetails right into it.
Sure does.
So besides best practices,
strangely enough, it's in your color.
Yeah.
We color code our questions, Robert. That's why.
That's how we smoothly know how to go back and forth between everything.
It doesn't really work all the time.
No, it doesn't really. So in besides good practices, what are the pitfalls? Like when you're, you know, when you've got a game with this social injustice and a superior authority that's enforcing it, what are like some pitfalls like, you know, that you need to avoid so that you don't make the game either unenjoyable, unsafe, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I would say you want to make sure that that you're all dialed into the way you're going to present those negative things. You know, is this the game where you're a bunch of people of color who are at home together, and so you're going to use whatever language, you know, you've experienced in your life, or you know, as just as an example, you need to make sure. I feel like I'm repeating myself, but yeah, the pitfall is to make sure that you don't become oppressive in pretending to be oppressive. And I have to say, like, I there's a lot of talk with people that I'm on the side of who say things like, oh, you know, if you can have a world with dragons, why can't you have a world with women leaders? And I totally agree with that. But also I think there's value in looking at the ugly things in society and saying, this is an ugly thing and what can we do about it? But then people who have to deal with that in their everyday life shouldn't have to deal with that just because I, as a white guy, or, you know, I, as whoever it might be playing the game, want to investigate that. You want to make sure that everyone's on board with it and everyone's on board with it at the level, that everyone wants to be. And so you want a game that in its world creation kind of flags all those things and draws you together, on the same page, or have tools that you can use to supplement games that don't have that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I had a thought as we were talking about this, because I could see where somebody might do this, and I could see where it might be a pitfall is to sneak a social injustice agenda into a game rather than being
very explicit about it.
Yeah.
Because then you can surprise somebody and trigger somebody.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was just, oh man, I had a thought and it fled because we talked about that instead. Never mind. Okay, next thing. Sorry about that. Darn.
I'm not the only one.
Yeah, that happens to me all the time. So let's say we have this campaign and you've fought the authority and won. What happens next? Should the campaign, is there another act that can be told? It sounds like when the authority is subverted in a bunch of ways, there's still play that's going on because you're not really done until somebody burns out.
Right. So you're not done until somebody burns out. And I actually will say in late play, it becomes interesting because everyone knows the numbers. And so you're just waiting for the dice to hit right to do the thing you want to do. So that one guy in your group who has only one thing left, he doesn't roll the first time, because he can't sell out on the first roll, and everyone wants you guys to sell out now while you're winning. So that guy waits until the numbers are bad or he rolls a lot. So it's really, it's interesting in that regard.
Yeah. It sounds like the structure of play is very, there's like an arc, right? Cause it's like, when you have a lot of your aspects, or I forget what they're called, your traits, I'm not sure what they're called.
Convictions.
Thank you. When you have a lot of your convictions left, you're still like a young, silly, kind of dumb, brash, bold teenager, and you're more willing to burn those things. But as soon as you start running out of them, you're more wiser and you're less willing to take the big risks like you were when you were younger, or at least younger feeling.
I see this sort of like the end of Misspent Youth is almost in some ways the middle act, right? Because you start out cool. That's one of your convictions you can have. You start out cool and then you can sell that out to trendy, or you start out optimistic and you can sell that out to cynical. And that's how the game ends, with you probably defeating the authority with at least one character, if not more, that are totally, you know, kind of rotten. But to me, the end of the story of optimism to cynicism is not cynicism, except for immature people. So these people aren't really growing up or becoming more wise. They're transitioning to a different state that then, you know, maybe another level would be to see what it really is to be genuinely optimistic rather than pie-eyed optimistic. And almost as though this is a commercial, there's a game for that in the supplement. In Misspent You Sell Out with Me, Kimberly Lamb wrote a game called Youth is Wasted on the Young, which is about youthful offenders, or formal youthful offenders, now called old fucks, who who fixed the world, and then it went back to shit again. So they have to come out of retirement to fix it again.
So where do they go from there if they're already cynical and not as optimistic as they used to
be? They start out with everything sold out, and then at key moments, you buy back your innocence.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah,
I get chills when I think about it.
That sounds like the actual full game. Like you play one and then you play the next one, and that's actually the whole like story of these youthful offenders.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a guy, Massiege, who's one of the fans in the Slack for the Gauntlet podcast, who is telling us in the Slack about basically from the 1960s to today of Polish politics and how fucked and awful it's been. And I was like, look, if you want to write something up by the 27th, I'll put it out on my Kickstarter, you know, backer update, and people will get to see this. And we got to talking about it, and he was like, yeah, I think I might want to do like the 60s, 70s, and 80s as Misspent Youth, and then like today as Youth is Wasted.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Love it. Oh, it's so good. Yeah, so our last question, which I think timing-wise, is actually pretty good.
Perfect, yeah.
Because we're rarely good on timing.
And I blabbed, so yes, great.
Yeah. So our last question is actually a little tricky. And that is, and I say tricky because even when it was asked in our G+ community, so this is actually one of our questions from our G+ community because I posted it out to them last week.
Great.
So what if somebody who's running the game is conservative, like in terms of our political landscape, and they want to include social justice or injustice in their game? What advice do you have for balancing like the game as well as their beliefs?
So I up until recently, I just disagreed with conservatives, but it's been hard to do more than that. So I'm going to try to be compassionate and think about the way I felt about people who call themselves Republicans before November. The game might not be for you. I'll start out by saying that. The game is very much about liberal politics. However, you could envision like a Harrison Bergeron thing, you know, where there's some like authority that's trying to make sure that everybody's the same, it strikes me that, like 1984 and, what's the Tuttle Buttle, the Terry Gilliam movie with, the guy from the Lexus commercials.
Oh, is it Brazil?
Brazil, yes. Brazil. Both of those dystopias seem to me to be like kind of a right-wing dystopia where you've got, you know, government in control of everything. So that's an easy way to go with it. But honestly, what I would love for conservatives to do is to take the procedures of the game, and all they're talking about is structural power. They don't actually say, you know, anything about conservative versus liberal, even though it's obviously liberal. What I would like is for someone to take those procedures and you tell me if you can be a conservative and play this game, because I would love to know. One of the very early games I played, someone was like, well, what if the authority is trying to force people to experience, sort of mind altering or sensual experiences, that they shouldn't. And I was like, this game's about increasing freedom, you know? And as constructed, I can't imagine that. But you could imagine, you know, drugs that are sold as a cool thing that are actually about, you know, destroying people that aren't liked, you know? Yeah, that's a really tough question. And I know that there are principled conservatives out there who I could have fun disagreements with. So I would love to see what they can make of the game.
Yeah, I mean, I wrestled with because I answered it in the G+ community as well. And part of what I wrestled with for it was framing the right question. And the closest I got, which seemed to go over well in the G+ community, was you have a king in a kingdom who's taxing everyone heavily. But instead of spending those taxes to rebuild the walls that have been, you know, torn down because of sieges and things like that, he's gone like all, you know, Louis XIV and like just gold plated all of his stuff.
Yeah.
And it's throwing lavish parties. And
yeah, I'm not sure if a villain who's aggrandizing himself through government is going to be a problem for Republicans right now, but
So, I mean, if I was going to, like, I guess, what are the conservative principles? You have to figure that out. And then you can, I mean, it's really, you sit down with a bunch of conservatives and ask them the same questions you ask about the game, right? Like, what are the things that bother you that you feel that I guess liberals, for lack of a different term or whatever, are doing that drive you crazy? And then see if that...
Well, bullies, right?
Yeah, what are those bullies doing?
Conservatives certainly see left-wingers as bullies sometimes.
And let's be honest, some left-wingers, especially on the extreme side, can be bullies.
Yeah, the internet lets people be assholes in lots of ways.
Yeah, and
you know what? I just thought of something. Speech control.
Gun control is a thing, you know, like... That's a thing that conservatives really want. They want their guns too. Like, speech control is another one. Like, there's a lot of things that can actually be thrown in that pool. If I'm going to play both, we should look at it from both sides. Cause I'm a liberal.
Yeah. I mean, that was the challenge for me. Cause I was like, oh, I'm like kind of super liberal about these things. I'm like, oh, how would you like, how do you get into that? And yeah,
if you put the thing out there, like, we are spending way too much money on helping the destitute and poor, and not because we're spending money on the destitute and poor, but because we don't believe we're doing it in the right way. Like, that is a thing that you can play with. Yeah. Those are ideas that you can play with. Mm-hmm. Especially if you were,
I would be really interested on the conservative side. And that's a really hard question.
It really
is. That's the hardest question I've ever been asked.
Yeah. I applaud our chat. I should say our G+ community. I applaud our G+ community for stepping up on, and bringing out some like really good questions. Yeah, the safety question was actually one of the questions from the community as well. Like, they were on the ball this week.
Cool. I have one question, and it's just if you can answer this one pretty quick before we get here. It's from the chat room.
Yeah.
Do you envision this game being played by teenagers? I mean, because you do have a teenage kid, and we were wondering if they've ever played this game, or if you have ever played this game with teenagers.
Yeah, he doesn't like tabletop games. He loves like old. He loves the video games that were the video games I played when I was a kid.
Oh, nice.
So unfortunately, not. I would love to play this with kids, or even better yet, for kids to hear the kids play this with each other. It hasn't happened so far, to my knowledge, or I could be misremembering because I have a terrible memory. But when I wrote it because like I wrote it as a game for adults about kids. But teenagers, basically, the adult level you need to play this game is teenage. So I would love it to see that. I think I've played once or twice at conventions with teenagers, but you know, there's a lot of cursing in the game, and so I just presume that most parents aren't going to be cool with that. And so, yeah, I really hope, if anyone knows out there of a game being played, let me know.
Well, I have access to a high school gaming club that is a bunch of teenagers. So maybe when school starts again, I'll see if I can bring this. If their advisor will let me bring this in and run it for them.
Ooh, that's a good one.
There you go.
And doesn't Tom Flanagan have a bunch of teenagers?
No, his kids are all a little older now.
Oh, okay.
He's got a couple of teenagers, but most of them are beyond that.
Most of them are older? Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, because that would be an AP.
All right. Like, well, it's 9:59, and we know you have to go. So, Robert, it was fantastic having you on to talk about this topic, which we all love very much around these parts. And before we go... to the chat room to talk to them, and before I let you get out of here, can you let people know where they can find you on the internet so they can give you and can you give them a quick refresher on you know, you don't have to do that, I'm just reading the copy and I shouldn't be here.
How about we just tell people, Rob, where do people find you on the internet?
Yeah, thanks.
Sure. I'm mostly on Google+ as Robert Bohl, B-O-H-L. I am also on Facebook and Twitter, although basically I use those as promotion holes right now, or at all.
Hey, by the way, that's why you blocked me, because I use G+ as a promotion hole and you got annoyed with me.
Maybe. I don't know what that is, and I'm so sorry.
It was like it was like 4 years ago, man.
Okay, good. Well, anyway, the only other thing I wanted to say is, you know, Kickstarter's on now. It's running until the 27th of July. And please come and pledge. I know it's already funded, but I really want to be able to, basically the whole point of this is to get games into distribution. That's what this Kickstarter is for. And I'd love it if we could, you know, get enough money to like position it well and maybe even get some ads for it, because I think this is a great game and I would love, for people to get, their hands on it.
Excellent. Very excellent. Well, Rob, thank you so much for being on the show, and, I hope you have a great rest of the Kickstarter and a great rest of your evening.
Thanks, everyone. Good night.
Thanks. Get some sleep.
Thanks for being here.
All right.
Hey, that was really good.
Yeah, that was really good, except for that copy flub at the end there.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
That's what I get for reading the copy, everybody. So was there anything going on in the chat room for life?
Nikki says that if we have a copy of the game, she can probably do something with getting it in the hands of her kids.
That's the group I was talking about.
You were talking about? Okay, so
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, that's the actual group that I was talking about. And I have a copy of the game.
Well,
so
there you go.
Yep.
All right.
That was awesome. Rob was great.
Yep.
That topic is near and dear to my heart because Hydro Hackers has
a lot of this baked into it, right?
In Hydro Hackers, water is controlled by a central authority, and you are not in control of...
Fight the man.
Yeah, you're drinking water, and you are fighting the man. And some of those questions I asked were like about the best practices and stuff, because there is this... you have to make it feel oppressive, but not hopeless.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, no one's going to want to play. Like, there has to be that element of hope. Like, there's, you know, otherwise you won't struggle.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That was weird because we just hung up on Rob. I'm not used to doing that, right?
Like, no, because usually we have somebody on. But the reason Rob left is not that he was disinterested in the show. He actually had a second event.
Yeah, he's got a Facebook Live event that he's producing.
Exactly.
For his girlfriend who just had a kid.
Yeah, so he actually was
pretty sure
able to be here and then needed to cut over to the other event. So I would like to note that that's the best we've ever done with staying on time with anything.
It's because I decided to take kind of charge.
Yeah. Well, that's because I kind of decided to stay quiet.
I know.
Yeah, see?
Regardless, we did it.
We did it. There we go. Huzzah.
I was just watching the clock and pacing us out.
Yeah, and I was being quiet.
All right.
All right. So nothing in the chat room?
No, we're good.
Oh, I'll just do this.
Do the thing.
It's the Extra Dimensional Social Media Depository, the Social Media Depository, whichever you prefer. And I said that really fast. Okay. Well, now that I feel like
you
I can
slow
relax,
down now, bud.
We're going to talk down. About a little get healthy action. Bob, what's going on in the get healthy section?
Night shift screws with my eating habits.
Yeah.
Because I end up just because of the nature of when I'm awake and when I'm asleep, I don't usually eat three meals like I would do during a regular day. I end up with like two meals and like something snacky depending. And they're at weird hours and everything. So my eating is screwed up, which usually is a benefit because I eat less. But I'm down another half a pound this week after the 4+ that I was down last week. So hopefully I can keep the trend going and get back into a reasonable area.
Is that down half a pound after that unbelievable ice cream and brownies we had on Sunday night?
Yeah, that was... probably what made it only a half a pound and instead of more than that.
So if you are in the Northeast and you've ever been to State College in Pennsylvania, so Penn State, has a delicious place on campus called the Creamery, which is an ice cream joint.
Yeah.
And it's pretty outrageous. And Nikki was so kind to make she was on campus for a conference and made a run to the Creamery. And brought back some righteous ice cream. And then, because Nikki's Nikki, was like, oh, well, we have ice cream. I'm going to make brownies.
Yeah.
And so we had brownies and ice cream.
Not just brownies, too. Brownies with, like, a gooey molten middle.
You know, I keep trying to suggest to her, like, and I wasn't there, of course, but I keep trying to subliminally and not so subliminally suggest to her that we have no willpower. So she should stop doing stuff like that because she's just going to make us all fat. And we're going to die early.
But see, here's the thing. Nikki is like the embodiment of all of my Italian aunts.
Uh huh.
Like it's that. Totally. Oh, are you hungry? Hang on a second, and then like comes out with this giant plate of food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nikki plus low willpower equals dead by 60.
Yeah, it's tough.
Just saying.
It is. What you call it? It is tough, man. But it's delicious. Tough.
Everybody out there listening, I'm just jabbing at her right now because she's in the chat room.
And we like to get smacked.
Because it's fun.
Yep, there it is.
Yes. Oh, you gave us a choice. Yeah. When I came back from taking a leak and found the bowl with the brownie and four scoops of ice cream in it, that was a choice that I had to make of eating the whole thing or saying, no, I can't.
It was delicious.
It was delicious. So David Walker... He'd been away a bit with vacation and such, and he came back 4 pounds up, but he didn't go crazy. He didn't fall off the wagon. He didn't go super strict. He went right down the middle and was like, that's okay. Just get back on the wagon. Just do the thing that I need to do and then get there.
That's the way to do it.
So there's a really good tip for folks out there. If things go wrong, just take a deep breath and just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah. Don't detonate everything just because, don't detonate everything just because like, you had a bad week, especially vacation stuff.
Yes, vacations will mess it up.
Because vacation eating, it's easy to eat well when you're in your normal habit
yep.
and doing your day-to-day routine. But it's like you said, when you switch to night shift,
yep.
When you go on vacation.
Changes of routine will screw with the process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just keep on chugging.
Oh, man, here's an interesting one. Carlin Kendrick, Carlin of the Hill People Kendrick, he's down 2 more pounds. He's been keeping track of his macros and went for an even percentage where he has equal amounts carbs, fat, and protein. And it's really keeping him up with his energy and keeping him down on his sugar and carb intake. That's a really good, thing to do. I mean, if you can get there, that's a great way to do this thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, and Eli Kurtz, he just finished the play that he was doing. And Eli, man, let us know how it was.
I mean,
if there's some stage combat, I'd be curious to hear it. If there's any like video recordings of it out there, I'd love to see them. So if you could throw those links in there somewhere, that'd be great. Yeah, there we go. So that's where we're at there. What's next? What are we talking about next? Are we talking about something with Jared Rasher? Weird random thought. Here we go. If you structure your campaign like a television series and organize things into seasons, etc., it makes sense to assume the same game system throughout. If you structure your campaign more like a movie series, we aren't playing this every week, just doing a 3 to 4 part story between other stories and things of that nature, does it make more sense to assume that the movie series structure might not use the same system throughout? Some movie series are very consistent throughout, but others vary quite a bit from one installment to the next, depending on director, writers, etc. I'm pretty sure Fast and the Furious changed game systems in there at least once. Not a fully formed idea, but something that was just bouncing around my head, since we now tend to frame a lot of ideas about ongoing campaigns in the series and television models.
I thought that was an interesting
question. Yeah.
I do like it. I mean, first of all, you often talk about campaigns structured as television series, mm-hmm. especially BBC television series.
I do, because they actually fit. It is the best example that I think that we have for how we actually run games.
Yeah.
From the stories that I hear from everybody else, it sounds like that's how it actually goes.
I'm trying to think if I have ever played a campaign that I have that I have jumped game systems other than Underground. We did Underground, but we did that like mid game. Like we didn't like play part of a campaign.
It wasn't it was because we wanted to play a different game.
I don't remember ever doing it. We've definitely had shifts in tone in campaigns where you would imagine that would have been something that may have worked with a different system just because of the tone shift, but we've, to the best of my knowledge, we've never actually changed up the actual system.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think.
It's an interesting concept.
Oh, it's definitely an interesting concept. I'm just trying to think of cool ways to use it. I mean, in some way, that was what that's what the D&D Immortals system was was trying to achieve, because that game was not the same as playing, you know, basic expert or whatever. Like, and the idea was that like when you reached immortality, it was time to like, you know, move up into a different realm of adventure. But it was I never grokked that addition to the game. Like I did the thing. I converted my character to an Immortals character and then was like, I don't know what to do with this now. Like I would have loved somebody to kind of usher me through that.
So here's the thing, about this question. I think is a worthy thing to do if you want to keep your characters and translate them from game to game so they have a different feel, because I think he's right, like Fast and the Furious changes. Because that is more of a Fast and Furious is actually a hill folk like drama system drama for the first game for the first movie or two, and then it turns into a heist game.
Yeah. So yeah. So one could easily switch that out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would go from drama system to I'd probably go with Fate, because it's really over the top.
And you could do like Fate Crime World, mm-hmm. so you could use the heist mechanics out of
Crime World. Yeah. Just have to get some driving mechanics in there to go with it.
Yeah.
Now, that is just the base example that I am using, because the idea is like, well, if you want a different set of mechanisms for your game to get a certain feel, then it behooves you to change game systems. But if you're already using a generic game system, you don't have to do that, because you can just change out some of the modules of the game to get the feel that you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're playing GURPS or Savage Worlds or Fate or one of those kind of universal games, or, you know, Numenera. Not Numenera, Cypher, because Cypher is the
base system. Yeah, Cypher's swappable.
Whatever the base system is, if you have the modules to plug in and plug out, then that's actually a lot easier lift than trying to convert your characters and learning a whole new game system. Unless you already know the game system, then it's fine.
Yeah, or unless you're just, you know, being polygamers and want to do a thing.
Yeah.
John Wick made a...
the game's terrible. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, what was it?
I forget, but it's
that little meta game.
It's called Flux or Phase or whatever.
Thanks for slapping me. It's terrible on it.
It is terrible.
The concept is interesting.
Yeah, but the execution's bad.
So the concept, I'll do the concept. We don't have to talk about the execution. The concept is like you're playing the same people, but you're getting bounced around like a multiverse.
Uh-huh.
So like you wind up embodied in the you just switch games. Like you mm-hmm. play some D&D, and then like when that guy dies, like you pick up,
build your new character into a different character.
Yeah, and then you know,
but you can still sometimes use mechanisms from the old game.
Yeah, that part. Now that you say that, seems interesting. I mean, I guess the one thing that I've done that I guess is kind of movie like, and Bob will remember this, is that I make the same character every time I play D&D.
Yeah, you do, which is weird.
I make the same.
Well, you make two essentially. Different, it's really two different characters.
No. I mean, third edition, fourth edition, and I didn't get a chance to do them in fifth edition, but I did them. My barbarian core. Yeah. So I played core for like 15 levels in 3.0,
mm-hmm.
and then when fourth came out, and originally the original player's handbook didn't have barbarian. I just made core. I mean, I completely changed everything about him and just called him core. I made a Dragonborn Warlord.
By the way, that game is called The Flux.
Yeah, The Flux.
So I was close.
But yeah, I mean, I've done that where I've kind of... And I'm trying to think, we did that. I wasn't the only player who did that when we switched to fourth. There were like one or two other players who kind of kept their old character names, and we just kind of like moved, like the world shifted and we just kept playing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I like playing rogues, but I don't always play the same rogue. I also like playing wizards these days. So
I want you to play DCC Wizard. It's crazy pants, man. It's so awesome.
I probably will then.
It's wicked crazy.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I guess so.
So I mean, I think it's fascinating. I'm just trying to think of the chain of games that I would want to put together to express an arc.
Why?
Well, I mean, I would do it just as an experiment. Like, I would play this game to tell a particular story, then this game to tell a particular story, and this game to tell a particular story. I'm just not sure which ones I would link together.
It seems like a lot of effort for not a lot of reward, considering the fact that if you're going to do that, you just pick a game with modules, and then you're basically doing that anyway.
Yeah.
By plugging in and pulling out modules, and you're making it less work on everybody else, so you can actually have more, unless really what everyone at the table wants to do is constantly be converting their characters... Then that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a thing where if everybody agreed to do it, then go ahead and do it.
So if that's your fun, you should do that.
Oh,
from an effort absolutely. From an effort level of view, that's a really ridiculously large amount of effort.
That?
Huh.
Although it was more of a bait and switch because I don't think he let the one game go on long enough. Brett did that when he did that game where it was like, oh, you guys are playing Delta Green, and then he just killed everyone. He was like, oh, you're playing Wraith.
Yeah.
That's funny. But I mean, that wasn't I don't think he played out like adventure upon adventure. I think it was just like, oh yeah, everybody make a Delta Green character. Yeah, you guys are great. Okay, you're all dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that actually seems rather reasonable.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it just seems a little,
I mean, that seems like the way to go. Like, since you're all dead now, we're going to play Wraith.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what do you do after that? Like, you're just done. Like, you don't go
for it. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, unless
then you play Exalted, like, you become, like, you know.
I guess.
I don't. I like the thought experiment of it is interesting. The application of it, I can't quite.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea that some people have tried, and it just doesn't ever seem to work well. And I look at Fate, and I'm like, well, it's right there for you. Like, Fate. Fate is like new GURPS.
Yeah, but even then, and I think you won't. I am hoping you won't argue with me on this. Fate has a particular type of feel. So even though it's generic and you can modularize and put a few things in and out, you're not really going to get hill folk out of Fate.
Yeah, you are. It's Romance in the Air. Romance in the Air has all the mechanisms to do that.
Yeah, but it's not the same. I mean, it's similar, right? It's petition granting, but it's still Fate.
Yeah, but it's without having to go through a whole different setup and all that good stuff, you have the mechanisms for it. That's the nice thing about Fate is it has all these little modules that you can plug and play as long as you know what the modules are.
Sure.
And then you can apply them in any way that you want. It's a nice thing to do so that you don't have to work so hard to get the kind of play experience that you want. Now, because I'm always thinking about how you can sell this stuff, right? Like, I mean, of course you can just go and do that if you really want to, but I don't.
Well, see, I mean, the thing for me is, like, I play games for a specific feel. So I play games for a specific feel. So for me, like, switching out games, I it's not a thing I really want to do because I just want to tell a story in a particular mechanism slash genre.
Uh-huh.
And then I want to go tell a different story in a different mechanism slash genre.
Yeah. I'm starting to see, as I read, and I have been looking at more Fate games, like, there's actually more flexibility there depending on how you skew where how some of those mechanics work and how you add some of those modules on there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot more in the SRD than there used to be on that Fate website. There's a lot more games out there that use Fate in different ways. It's a pretty solid base that can be changed upon pretty rapidly and easily.
The new Adversary book is due out.
Yep, it's true.
Yep.
Should be some interesting stuff.
Yeah, you need to score that. All right. Well, I think we've pounded on that quite a bit.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's
good time to go away.
Yeah, are we at the point where
Patreon shoutouts?
Where we do
Patreon shoutouts.
Yeah. Robert Aducci, one of the hosts of Bone Stone Obsidian.
Yeah.
Which the second episode will be out as probably when you hear this. Craig Just Craig. Eileen Barnes, who has this really lovely black mage icon on our Slack. I love the black mage in Final Fantasy games. In fact, Vivi from Final Fantasy X is one of my favorite characters of all time. So there's that. Stephen Farrell and Scott Robinson. Thank you all so much for being our patrons. Yes. We greatly appreciate it. Is there anything in the chat room?
No, we are good.
Oh man, I was hoping somebody wanted to argue with me.
No arguing at the moment.
That's unfortunate.
If you want to argue with Chris, wait till the after show. We'll open up arguing with Chris.
Well, thank you everyone so much for listening.
If you are free Tuesday evenings, 8:45 p.m., 6:45 p.m., the Queen's time, come join us live on Twitch where you can chat with other listeners in the awesome chat room for life and ask us questions. And if you step out of line, prepare to receive the ban hammer.
Uh-huh. Boom. If you can't make it to the live show, check out our podcast each week wherever you get your podcasts. Then take a listen to some of the other shows in the Misdirected Mark Network, such as Down with D&D, Threats from Gallifrey, Vanished, Insight, Pandas, Talking Games, Cypher Speak with Darcy and Troy, The Gnomecast, The Streets of Avalon with the Wednesday Evening Podcast All-Stars, and Hobbs and Friends of the OSR. You can and should also check out some of our brother and sister podcasts, She's a Super Geek, The Knights of the Night, and the always amazing Gaming MBS.
After you have listened to the show and before you sell out completely to the man, leave us some feedback. You can reach us directly at Chris the Man, chris@misdirectedmark.com.
I'm not the man. I fight the man.
Phil@misdirectedmark.com.
He's the man. He likes to be in charge.
Bob@misdirectedmark.com.
Deny it.
Yeah, I don't. I love being in charge.
See, there you go. The man sitting across
from me. I love being in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Check out our Facebook group. Hit us up on Twitter @misdirectedmark, @DNAPhil, @RobertMEverson, @TheLight101.
Who is always fighting the man.
Yes, or go hang out with all of our other misspent youth in our G+ community.
They are the best. The best. Absolute best. Hey, you know, if you like what we're doing here, and on some of the other shows in the Misdirected Mark Network, we have Patreon campaigns. We have many of them, in fact, at this point in time.
Yes.
The one for this show in particular is patreon.com/MMP. We are always looking for more people, because when we get to a certain amount of money, which is our next goal, Bob will shave his head, and yes, we'll record it, and we'll yes, have a Twitch, we'll have a video of it on YouTube. We'll do it live.
God,
we'll
announce it.
You know you want it.
I have the clippers, man.
You know you want it.
I have the clippers here.
There's some other things that happen when we get to that level, too. Like, Phil and Senda both wear panda outfits again and record live.
Yep.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You can all do me a favor and get that done by the QCC so I can record. I can stream that live from the QCC. I greatly appreciate that.
That'd be awesome. Would you love that? I just, like, roll around on the floor with, like, some
bamboo. We'll get Phil some bamboo, and he can roll around the floor and eat the bamboo.
Totally down with that.
That's a thing that will happen. All right?
Yeah.
All right, well, you also, if you're going to patron us, you get a lot of stuff. Like, there's the after show, there's pre-production show notes, there's musical parodies, which we haven't had one in a while, but I think we should probably have one sometime in the next
month
or two.
There's one in the hopper that Senda hasn't had time to do that I wrote, like, 6 months ago.
There's actually, like, four or five in the hopper. I have the hopper. There's, like, four or five. Senda's been kind of busy before she can, like, do a full sit-down and mix.
Hey, folks, you should get us to our next Patreon goal, or I'm going to take one or two of those and sing it myself.
Uh-oh.
Threatening to sing stuff.
You want to do a duet?
I mean, yeah, really, we'll do a duet.
We'll just mangle something.
Yeah, there you go.
Oof.
Don't threaten them like that, because they'll do it.
they're
no, they have to get there, or we're going to do it.
No, that's what I mean.
No, because they'll just want to see it.
They'll want to see it.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Well, here, let me flip it the other way then. If you get there, then we will do it.
There you go.
Yes, something like that.
Yeah.
Do something, and we'll do something in response.
jack our numbers up.
That's what will. That's what's going to happen. If you do something, we're going to do something.
Spread the word.
Spread the word. Panda's Talking Games bonus outtakes, which are always hilarious.
Yes.
Oh, we're doing the ending. Is that what's happening here? I totally lost it with that sidetrack.
I know,
discussion.
Right?
Sorry. Good. Wrap it up.
I'm having fun here,
yeah,
man.
Okay, get to the thing.
Then there's there are always going to be other kinds of special releases as we can put them out there. Well, with that, this has been another episode of Misdirected Mark Podcast, which is a Misdirected Mark production, which is also the media arm of Encoded Designs, which makes games, which is run by most of us that are sitting at this table. And then I will say mic drop.
Stick it to the man. We out.